I'm gonna record. Why not? See what we see if anybody else wants to listen to us. So again, publicly and for the internet, thank you for getting Robbie Foreman's book. And so I obviously have to talk about it and talk about what he says about Lech Lecha, but I'm not going to do that because you should get the book and read it yourself. But I'm going to talk about what he talks about. And because he talks about it, it's all about the Gaiva chiasmus. And obviously you know what that is. And it's one of those words that always sounds fancy because it comes from Greek. Like, Endiadis. Means two for one in Greek, but saying two for one doesn't sound fancy. Hendiadis sounds like a fancy term. So all these rhetorical terms sound Greek. So chiasmus means in Greek, Xing, marked with an X. Greek letter key, it's an X. And entirely unrelated, but I thought it was fascinating. Mitch Wolf taught me that there's a word in Tanakh for the same thing, for marking with an X. If you look in Yechezkel, he describes a vision where he sees the angels marking all of those who protest the abominations of the time. We're going to save those. Vayomer Hashem, and Hashem said, Elu, these, talk about these angels that are running through the people, Avor b'toch ha'ir, go travel among the city, b'toch Yerushalayim in Yerushalayim, v'hatavita tav, and mark with a tav, the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and you will taf a taf al mitzchot harashim, on the foreheads of those people, hananachim v'nanakim, who are crying and groaning, al kol tevot, all these abominations, hanaso b'tocha that are being done here. Why a taf? Because if you look at ancient Hebrew, tav ivrit, that's what a taf looked like. It was just an X. Same thing. Obviously, marking things with an X is a thing. So chiasmus is the same thing. That's marked with an X. And it's called that in poetry because biblical poetry is all about the parallelism. One line parallels the other one, and sometimes the words go in the opposite order. So if you did the diagram, this is the second pasuk of Ashrei. B'chol yom avarchecha b'alashim kalalam ve'ed. Always I'll bless you and I'll praise you forever. So it's the same thought, same terms, same themes, let's put it that way. But in reverse order. So there's your little X, that's your key. And then, as I said before, is a specific form of chiasmus, which is anti-metaboly, where you're using the actual words. And that comes up more in English, like the all for one and one for all. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It's a rhetorical term. It makes it more poetic. And you remember these sorts of things well. And it comes up a lot in biblical poetry.
Danny, weren't you impressed that I knew that one? Off the top of my head.
I am very impressed. That is a great line, Aaron. That is a great line. It's very poetic. And it makes the point that I'm going to quote James Kugel, who's a professor at Harvard, who wrote the book, literally the book, which was The Idea of Biblical Poetry, that there isn't
he
some...
Wrote that book? He wrote the Bible as it was.
He may have written that too, but the one I have that, you know, this is more of a, this is a scholarly book.
The idea of biblical poetry. Okay, not the art of biblical poetry.
No, this is the idea. The question is, what does it mean? If people talk about biblical poetry, he points out that there is no such thing as poetry versus prose, that all of Tanakh is a spectrum. There are things that are more poetic, more prosaic, but even a purely really halachic line like this one is poetic. And that comes up again and again. But he points out that in terms of why do I care about this chiasm, it may not mean anything. Because it may simply be, well, we just don't want it to be too boring, too monotonous, so I'm going to change the word order. That differentiation, different words, different orders, is also behind the frequent use of chiastic word order. This is cool. Of course, chiasmus is a well-known trope of Greek and Latin literature, where the word comes from, and has been all too readily assimilated to such biblical uses since the days of the church fathers. There's another problem with looking at things as all as chiasmus, because it was originally a Christian idea. We're going to look at the poetry of the Bible. And it's all making an assumption, well, we know what poetry is because we read Aristotle's Poetics, and real poetry comes from the Greeks. And so the Bible has poetry, so it must follow the same kinds of rules. So I'm going to apply it. but chiasmus in Hebrew, while undeniably provides the same aesthetic pleasure as European languages, we like hearing that, chofech dam adam adam badam dam yishafech, we remember that well, ought rightly not to be separated from the context of parallelism itself. That is, where it appears in Greek or Latin more or less out of the blue, in other words, Greek poetry doesn't use parallelism, so if you notice this a reversing word order kind of structure, it means it's intentionally there. In Hebrew, it's truly concomitant of the binary structure of parallelistic sentences that the key is to look for the parallelism and the contrast comparison between the two halves, not so much, oh, look, the words are going in reverse order. That's just not that big a deal. So I get a little skeptical about everyone pushing chiasmus. The other side of it is that the literal meaning of it in terms of one line with two halves in reverse order is not the way we use it in the modern Tanakh analysis. We talk about it more in terms of the structure of the entire story, of themes going from A to B and then from B to A. Not individual psukim, not individual words, but of entire themes. And that's we'll look at that. And that's really when everyone's looking at chiasm, and they're looking at, you know, the entire Sefer Shemot, or as I did in the Tanakh class, the entire last half of Shmuel Aleph. And this is the way Professor Yonatan Grossman, well, I think it's at Bar Ilan, but this is from his Shirim at the Gush, put it. He's talking about Mavana Kiasti. The chiastic structure, umavana, concentri, and concentric, where we have two themes that are, the themes are reversed order, and there's a central point. That's source three. Kvar lifnei k'matayim shana, and it's been already been 200 years. Amdu chokrim, the researchers, people who study biblical literature, al kach, they understood. She'im ha-pasuk ha-boded, onu uma katzar, that if you have one pasuk, a lone pasuk, everyone knows the word bidud now, on the Uma Katzer, or a short quote, Mutzim b'mavana kiasti, are designed around a chiastic structure with a theme and then reversing the order. Hagareshi ten shigam, it's true that you can see also sipurim shleimim, entire stories, o'af sfarim shleimim, or entire books, Mutzavim b'mavana murgan shakazer, they're designed with the same kind of structure. This idea is connected with the names of Jeb and Boys and Bollinger. These are all early 19th century Protestant theologians. Yeah, so this idea has been pulled wholeheartedly into the Gush way of looking at Tanakh, and we'll talk about why. But it didn't start with the Jews. They publicized their work, Machasita Rishna Shel Me'ah Tishim Ve'asara, that they did their work in the first half of the 19th century. Me'az V'arayom, and from then on, Rabu HaKotvim, everybody says is a Pashanim, She'hitz'iyu Mavanim Kiastim U'Koncentrim, that they've suggested chiastic or concentric structures, the Prashiot Chok, to the legal sections of Tanakh, Nevot, and the Nevi'im, Mizmarim, poetic sections, Siparim Shonim, and to various stories. He gives a classic example. You look at Megillah Esther. I'm going to make that small. I can put it all on one screen. More. There you go. That's the whole structure over here. Right, we go from the royal power of Achashverosh, who Achashverosh, Melech Hodakush, and we end with Vayasem Abraham Achashverosh Masal Koliyam, the power of Achashverosh. We go the two feasts of Persia to the two Jewish feasts. Esther comes before the king, back and forth. So you go in this order here, all the way through, and then we center around the center point, which is the king can't sleep and the climactic meeting with Haman. And then it goes backwards. Haman talks to his family, parallel to Haman talks to his family. For Esther's first feast, parallel to Esther's first feast. We have the stories going in one order, the pivot, and the stories going in the reverse order. That's a chiastic structure. Not of psukim, not of words, but of themes throughout the whole Sefer. It's a nice way to look at it, and it makes the point, two things, actually. is proposed for the meaning behind the chiastic structure. There, one is, as Rabbi Forum puts it, it's a bullseye. It draws our attention to that central point. This is the climax of Megillat Esther.
Like a Purim parade.
Yes. Right. That is why that is the Purim parade, because that is the climax. That's where you say, Amelech. Right? That's a, that is the chapter that is the kind of the center of it. It's also the turning point. That this chiastic structure, the idea of the X is that there's someone going up and something, there is an emphasis that's increasing, emphasis that's decreasing. Here it's the power throughout the story. Haman's power reaches a peak early and then decreases. The Jews are at their lowest point early, and then the power of the Jews increases as it goes through. So thematically, there's that X. The two lines intersect, and they intersect at this point where it's clear that Mordechai is on the way up, he's riding the horse, and Haman's on the way down. So the problem then is, it's cute, but why do it? Why look for this kind of structure? There's no hint in traditional sources. None of the Mephorshim mention anything about this idea of a chiasm or of crossing lines or of themes that repeat each other, but in reverse order. And I think part of the reason why we do it, and we always do it, it all comes up over and over again, is because it's fun. It's rewarding. You can pose the meaning there, but honestly, it has this, what I call a Bible codes feeling. You know, it looks like you're finding arbitrary things. You're pulling pieces here and saying, yeah, this parallels that. And they're not symmetric. So it's a little bit uncomfortable there, because I feel like you're almost reading too much into it. I take any book and can I say, well, any book that has a climax, can I say there's a chiastic structure in there? Well, it's boring at the end and kind of moves to a climax. I can pull there. But I think there's something deeper there. The fact that a reformer likes this and he's using Lech Lecha isn't wrong, but I think there's a problem that it's addressing. The problem is that the Torah doesn't have structure. Things happen in apparently random order. Especially if things get repeated. Right? You have the same, you clearly have the same concepts going back and forth, sometimes contradictory to each other, sometimes they just repeat the same thing. And you know, what do you do with that? And traditionally,
the fact that the Torah as a whole can't be pigeonholed and structured, it doesn't mean that individual sections, individual psukim, I mean, you're not looking for it. It is there.
Okay, and that's kind of I agree that it's there, and that's what we're finding, but what's interesting is that this is a new thing. It's a new way of looking at Kitzvei HaKodesh. That the traditional Mephorshim don't do that at all. But I think it's worth noting. Okay, I mean, you think it's there, and some of them just seem very obvious once someone points it out. That, oh yeah, obviously it's got this reverse structure. I mean, nobody points out that Shofech Dama 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 Yishofech. None of the Mepharshim comment on the fact that it is clearly anti-metabolic, which is interesting, because this quote here is the way everyone until about 200 years ago looked at it. Divrei Torah aniyim b'makoman v'ashirim b'makomacher, Yerushalmi. Okay, fine. Torah says one thing in one place, and it'll put more details in another place. And no one says, well, why? Why not put everything into one story? Why not put it together? So the academic answer is because we're looking at lots of different documents that are the documentary hypothesis that we're putting, these were random older retellings of stories that were assembled by a redactor. That's why they're all repeated. That's why they had different details and they're all put together, thrown together. There's no order there. Aside from being anathema, it's the wrong thing to say about the Torah, right? Hashem. Even for Nach, you say it was written by people, but it misses the point because the text we have is a unitary text. And if I say there's no structure there, even if I say it's made out of parts, whoever wrote the parts, then I'm saying that the redactor was drunk or asleep. You're muted, I can't hear you.
Maybe that was for the best.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, I think anathema is a strong word. for this. Because, like, James Kugel himself, he, I don't know.
Well, he definitely would go with the documentary hypothesis. And I
would, that an anathema when applied to Torah?
I think it is a wrong thing. It is completely wrong. And I do agree that it is wrong to use a documentary hypothesis for the Torah. I will not reject somebody who claims otherwise, but that's me. Okay, that's where I'm starting from.
The Torah. Okay, Torah. And then
Nach, I will grant that it is written by people and maybe composed of lots of pieces, but I would still argue that the pieces were put together, not randomly thrown. So if we still have these pieces, we assume that they were put together in the order and so on. It was composed.
Yeah, I mean, it disagreeing with you on Nach doesn't mean that the disagreeer thinks.
Okay, nothing you're reading here. Drunk. I think it's anathema for Torah specifically, and even for Nach, where I would grant that the documentary hypothesis is okay. It misses the point if I just say, oh, that these pieces were just put together. These are separate pieces. Saying that they are separate pieces doesn't answer anything.
No one assumes the redactor was drunk. By putting that as the opposite.
I do. Okay, this is the way Mayor Sternberg puts it, and I love it because he is definitely academic. Have you read the Poetics of the Biblical Narrative?
No.
He's a professor at Tel Aviv University.
You mentioned him, the Poetics of Biblical Narrative.
Yeah. Incredible abuse of this resource and the investigation of its text source. You know, trying to find the sources. For over 200 years, a frenzied digging into the Bible's Genesis, so senseless as to elicit either laughter or tears. Rarely has there been such a futile expense of spirit in a noble cause. Rarely has such grandiose theories of origination built and revised and pitted one's and whether on an evidential equivalent of the head of a pin. Really, if so many worked so long and so hard, with so little to show for their trouble.
Okay.
And that was all we have. We do not have pieces anywhere. You can't say, here's evidence for a piece. All we have is a text as it is. And so you can assume anything you want there. So I'm going to look at this and say, yes, there's a structure here. And everything, this was written as the cold text, even if it was composed from parts that are put together beforehand. Because I think that's the part that I think that that's what I would argue. I think that's the opposite to the drunk redactor. Because the drunk redactor argument does come up. But the reason why this is here and not there is because, well, this was the one story, this is the other. And they just put them together because all these texts were holy and nobody knew didn't want to reject anything. So we just put them together. So this is the way Rob Kupperman says. He was the founder of Michlalah. His famous work was Pshuto Shel Mikra. He's talking about why we're looking for this structure now, and it doesn't come from the question, is because we're looking for the answers to the questions that we ask. And those questions weren't asked beforehand, before we had the whole academic side of it. This is the way he puts it. Ken, when we're coming to learn Torah and to teach to others, we have to be alert to what the people of this generation are thinking, to their feelings. The Toka de Limud Torah, Horata, and to learn Torah and its teachings, the Nasot, the Salik, and Kushim, the Subi et, Ha Mukushim, Ha Mdim Bidarchena. And we need to understand the questions and remove the stumbling blocks that stand in our way, ubidarcham, and the way of the people we're teaching. We have to answer the questions that are being asked. Lavanat Torah, al Torat Kodesh, Ketorat Chayim, we need to look at the Torah as a living Torah. Allah nalasok b'sheilot, we have no business dealing with questions, asher avar zmanan, that have already passed. V'avadai she'allah l'orer bayot, mizmerot she'evru, and we certainly shouldn't reawaken questions, in order to revisit questions that nobody cares about nowadays. This is something that happened to me, Rav Kupperman says. La'aruch michadash, the pirusho shel Rav Professor David Tzvi Hakman. David Tzvi Hakman was an Orthodox academic rabbi in Berlin in the end of the 19th century, contemporary of Hirsch, who wrote a lot arguing against the documentary hypothesis. He's quoted by Art Scroll. But I had the opportunity to edit a new edition of his works. In order to make it more contemporary. In order to create a new commentary on the Torah for the new next generation. We're just gonna use Hoffman's answers and kind of update the wording. My answer was, that if we want to be faithful to what David Tzvi Hakman did and the way he interpreted Torah, asur lasokei, that we cannot rewrite his commentary. Just like Rav Hoffman didn't deal with the problems that the Rambam dealt with, right? How do I make Torah consistent with Aristotelian ethics and physics? That's just not a question. But he was dealing with the questions that came up in learning Torah in Europe in the 19th century. We shouldn't try to resuscitate the questions that he is addressing. That they've already been, they're no longer alive. In order to deal with them again. Instead of this, we need to deal with the questions that are relevant to us now. Let's see the chat here. I should add dates to the books I'm citing here. Okay, so this would have published in the 1980s. Yeah, Rav Kupperman passed away just, I think, in the past 4 years.
So what does he mean, problems they worried about then, and we don't want to think about again, and problems today?
Well, what bothers the modern, Michalas student? It really isn't Bellenhausen. And if it is, and the documentary hypothesis directly. If it is, then we can address it. But that's kind of his point, is that a commentary written now needs to be addressing the questions that we are worried about now, of which an important part is, and he's going to go into that next paragraph, is the why of all this repetition. That comes up a lot. From the time I started teaching Torah and its teachings, I felt that the biggest question, the central question, that bothers the intelligent questioner, who madua kol afkul kach, why is everything so backward? I am dati, I believe that there is pshat and there is drash, but why doesn't the halacha just follow the pshat? I mean, why would if the Torah means yad, tachat yad for monetary payment, why not say that? That's what Pshuto Shel Mikra is all about. He's got, it's huge, two volumes all on dealing with that question.
Is this related to Ein Mukdam U'Meuchar question?
It would be. That's a structural question that clearly bothered Rashi and clearly bothered the Ramban. Okay, well, why put it this way? Why not have the Pshat be just simple? He's giving an example. Why does the Torah divide the laws of an Eved in three different places? If we're not going to accept documentary that these are three different traditions of laws, right? We're assuming this is all, the Torah Shel Peh is unitary. This is halakha. We learn from here and here and here and here. So why write the Torah that way? We can learn from one or the other, but why have one or the other? I could have learned it all together. Why not put it all together? So that's the introduction to his two-volume magnum opus, and that's pages 3 to 4. Okay, maybe that's, he's got another 1,000 pages dealing with this. So I'm not going to read it all. I haven't read it. I'm on chapter 4, I think. Okay, but in terms of the structure, this analysis of chiasmus is one of those answers, in terms of narrative especially, because the idea of it gives us a feeling about the text, that this is centering around a central point. So why we read it, why we look for this chiasmus, because it gives us that structure that otherwise we don't have, and we need that. And I would argue that Rashi did not. Rashi didn't feel the lack, okay, well, why is this in such an order? Just say, here's a word here that we learned for a word here. Or here's a story that happened, here's another story that happened. And for me, saying, wait a minute, it's the same story. Why has it come up twice? Did it really happen twice? And that's what Rabbi Foreman is doing in Parshat Lech Lecha. He's looking at the end of Parshat Lech Lecha, which talks about, the end of Parshat, it talks about the Brit. Let's actually bring that up. We can see it. Reshit, go, come on. Yud Zion. And it starts out, Vayhi Avram ben Tishim Shana v'Tesha Shanim. He's 99. He's 9 years old. And he's going to go through basically Pasuk Yud Zion is his structure here. This part here. And he ends up, I start with Avram's age, I end with Avram's age. And he goes through that continually. Avram in the beginning falls on his face. Avram in the end falls on his face again, face with Hashem. Same expression, right? The bracket of children, that's repeated 2 times. He even makes a pun, which is very Rabbi Foreman, say the words are similar to each other. When he looks at the brief meal, let's look over here. In terms of Brit Mila, Arel Zachar Salo Yimol Pesar Alato, someone who doesn't do Brit Mila, Mechrata Nefesh Behu Me'ameha, and this person will be cut off from his land at Briti Hefer. He has annulled my Brit. And the parallel is to, look what he did over here, and Pasuk Vav. There we go. Beforehand, says, and I will make you fruitful. And he says, hefer, they're different shoreshim, right? One's hefer, he pei resh, the other is pre pei resh yud. But still, it sounds very similar. So when I say, hefreti otcha b'mod ba'od, when I make you fruitful and I create the nation, if I don't have a community, then epriti hefer kind of is the opposite of that. Now you're kicked out of the community. You're no longer part of the hefreti otcha. Again, not the same word, but the sounds are the same. When I'm reading it, it makes me think, okay, this part above corresponds to Yadala there at the end. So he says there's this whole structure. And this is the structure that he puts in puts together, goes from Avram is 99 years old, and he talks about that he's about to be 100, beginning, end. Avram falls on his face at the end when he talks to Hashem. Avram gets the bracha being the Hayita Av Hamon Goyim, and then at the end of this, Sarah is going to be the mother of Brechti Vayital Goyim. Sarah is going to be the mother of nations. And then after that, for Avram, we have his name change. So first is the bracha of Hamon Goyim, and then he gets the bracha of name change. For Sarah, first is the name change, and then it's the bracha of nations. Now, I wouldn't have noticed that. I wouldn't have cared, but now it kind of tells me, well, I have this reversal of order for things that say the same thing. Well, that tells me, okay, I'm looking at this chiasm. Then we have the Hifreti versus Briti Hefer. Like, I will become a nation, then I will cut them off from the nation. Then we have the Akavoti Briti Udorotam, and then Haita Briti V'Saram, the Brit. Hashem's side of it forever. Man side of it forever, and then Hashem's promise, the terms of the Brit, which is Natati Zarachat Eretz Mugarecha, get the land, and the terms of the Brit from Avram's side is Himolachem Kol Zachar. Again, the Dorotam and the term, the foreverness of the covenant and the terms of it. Here it's the terms and then the foreverness. Reversing the order of the themes tells us that this is kind of this chiastic structure for the end of the parsha. And the center of all of this is Yatat Briti Shemor, that you need to keep this brit. So this is the chiasm that he's talking about. The X form, the themes that one rising and one falling, is the role of Hashem versus the role of man. The first half is Hashem's side of it. It doesn't quite fit with the Abram falling on his the father. This is Abraham on the first part and Sarah's name change on the second. The second part is the man's side of the Brit. And the central point that it goes around is keeping the covenant. That this is what makes you a nation is the Brit itself. And he has to cheat a little bit because he's got to, I'm going to bring this back up, in order to make his point about the chiasm, he has to go from here to here. He skips the part about Yishmael, which is this last half. Even though if you really want to look at it, this is a much tighter parallel because this starts with Avram ben Tishim Shana and then Va'Avram ben Tishim Shana. One would like to make this whole thing into a chiastic structure, beginning and ending with Avram being 99. But he's got this middle part that really doesn't have about Yishmael, that doesn't really have a parallel in there. But that's always a problem with finding these kind of structures, is that something doesn't quite work. But it tells us, what do we know? That B'nai Yisrael are become a nation, not because of the shared history, not because of their land. Those are true, but that's not what makes us a nation. It's because of the Brit. Again, the chiastic structure moves in that X, the role of Hashem in the first half, and the role of human beings in the second half, centered around that Pibra Brit Tishmor, and that's where he summarizes that the primacy of the covenant speaks to the special nature of Israel's nationhood. Crack open any history book and read up on how nations come to be. Strong man manages to aggregate a group of warriors around him, and they conquer a plot of land. Nation is born, the chief strong man is king. That's not how it worked with us. We were taken out with signs and wonders by the master of the universe himself, and brought to the land of Canaan. That we are a nation not to a human leader, but to the divine master of all. And that's what this lesson of this X marking the very end of Lech Lecha is. And that's what I would have said if people had come. I'm going to stop recording.